Next room for us.
Thank you for coming to this probably one of the worst timed sessions in the conference, but for a topic that we hold very dear to our hearts. My name is John Miller. I'm with the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS, and this is Stefan German from World Vision International and also on our steering committee, and we'll be co-chairing this session on the role of families in HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. A year ago, the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and AIDS presented its findings, and we saw really very compelling evidence that families were backstopped by communities and shouldering the majority of the care and financial burden for children affected by AIDS. The recommendations and evidence from the Joint Learning Initiative's findings pointed very clearly to a social protection agenda, which was already gaining a lot of evidence and which we were pleased to see gain some momentum then. But one of the other findings of the Joint Learning Initiative prompted some initiative on the behalf of the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS to promote and gather evidence and give prominence to some work that had been going on for some time, and that was that service provision was not adequately supporting families. We organized a series of meetings on family-centered services last year and commissioned a series of academic papers on the subject, some of which have been published in a special issue of the Journal of the International AIDS Society, and there are copies at the back if you wish to get them. What do we mean by when we say family-centered services? These are services that recognize that we do not live in the world as individuals, but rather with people whom we love and consider family, whether there be biological families or chosen families, in other words, however we define them. And the evidence is crystallizing. These models do have a greater chance of producing better outcomes in both adults and children. But something else became clear as part of our meetings, that these models often aren't friendly to especially marginalized communities. Drug users, men who have sex with men, sex workers, migrant and refugee communities, prisoners. These presentations in this session today will touch on various aspects of this topic. So I'm going to turn it over to my co-chair to introduce you to the first speaker.
It's my pleasure to introduce us, our first speaker, Marina Damayan. She is working with World Vision in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. She is a public health professional and has many years of experience in health and HIV within that region, and specifically related to children in at-risk situations and marginalized population groups. Marina, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I will be sharing about children of especially marginalized group and a little bit of our experience in the field with family-centered approaches to help prevention of HIV. I will share a little bit about vulnerabilities and risks and challenges that exacerbate those vulnerabilities and risks for children and youth in the region. I will share four examples from four different projects in the region, and also some key recommendations and learnings that we had from those programs for importance of the family-centered approaches when it comes to HIV prevention and prevention of risks and vulnerabilities for children and youth. Well, it is not news that this region is unique in terms of the political and socioeconomic transition since the crash of the Soviet Union. For those many years, we are still struggling. We have that rapid social change that is still ongoing. The war and armed conflicts are here and there ad hocly happening, and political unrest is a norm. There is a huge gap between rich and the poor in the region, and of course, the environment is not helping HIV prevention either. So basically 20% of children, according to UNICEF data, live with single parents, and with very, very easy access to drug and alcohol, it increases their risk and vulnerability, of course. The third of HIV-positive people are women and girls, and then 58% of women and girls reported they never heard about HIV and AIDS, so you can imagine the risks and vulnerabilities for those children, women and girls. So the innovative employment opportunities are there as well. Labor migrants, it's a normal job to be a labor migrant, especially in Caucasus and Central Asia. People leave to for breadwinning purposes to Russia and Ukraine mostly, which are the high prevalence countries in the region, to Turkey as well. So this is the most popular job now for Central Asia and Caucasus. But at the same time, they leave their children behind, in many cases by themselves or with grandparents. The most popular job opportunities for children and youth is also sex work and drug dealing. And those are unspoken issues. And I do want to emphasize that these issues are unspoken, hidden. There is no much data about this, but we see this throughout programming. We know because we live in this region. And traditionally, family is the primary provider of protection, care, and support, influencing child social development. That's the norm. It's still there, but because of the confused hierarchy of values and norms and social identity of parents and children, a lot of changes happened. And risks are not limited only to HIV, but there are many, many risks that I already mentioned that exacerbate the risk of HIV. It is more about vulnerability than orphanhood in this region, as opposed to Africa, for example, when we're speaking about OVC. And again, those vulnerabilities are not spoken about. The huge army of street children, for example, exists in this region, but no one does real, targeted, tailored programs for HIV prevention for them. And there is lack of focus for HIV, for vulnerability and risk reduction in general, but at the same time, lack of focus on family-centered approaches. So those weakened family ties, reversed hierarchy of traditional norms, and the system replacement, basically family and friends are replaced with drugs and alcohol in most cases. This is the environment that our children and youth live in. So I want to share with you the enabling environment framework that World Vision uses for its programming, because this is the center of our decision why family-centered approaches matter. And this is based on ecological model that most of you are familiar with, I guess. Individual, in this case child and youth, are the center. And then their immediate environment is the family or institution where they live in, or teachers in this institution, or their immediate peers. And then we as World Vision target spiritual support as well. So faith leaders and congregations members would be the next circle. And then bigger circle is the social environment, where we have AIDS centers, for example, we work with, other NGOs who we partner with, larger community leaders and opinion makers. But most importantly, we target the immediate environment. And I want to say that we didn't do it for many programs, but then we learned through our experience that that should be the case. So the first example I want to share is from Uzbekistan. And this is one of our long-term programs that we had, and it was closed recently because of the political reasons. And we were targeting injecting drug users and sex workers in one city, in the capital city of Tashkent, through trust points, and it was a comprehensive program. So we targeted all those layers. But we failed to focus on children and families because it was really a harm reduction program focused on sex workers and drug users. We learned through our program that we need to target families. We need to target those children who live in those families and wives and dependents of drug users and sex workers. So we paralleled another program, and we learned that because we started speaking to children and the dependents. So in that particular program, we added the dependent counseling element, and we did it in 5 out of 10 trust points. It proved to increase the attendance by drug users. It proved to improve their own access to services and they avoid self-stigma. The next program I want to share about is our program in Caucasus. We do in 3 countries, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan. And we are targeting labor migrants, who I mentioned that mostly leave their children behind by themselves or with mothers or grandparents. So we are targeting the family itself. And I remember our donors questioned that. They asked, you're not targeting migrants, really. You are targeting their families in the first place. Yes, because we learned through our other programming that targeting family will help migrants. And the targeted promotion of VCT use by children for their fathers works. And prevention messages that the family gives to the labor migrants who is coming back home for a few months work. The other program that we have is in Russia. So we targeted vulnerable children and youth. And you may know that in Russia, the families are split into two types. It is normal families, which means parents are normal. They are no drug users or excessive alcohol consumers. Or maladapted families, which is the alcohol consumers' families or drug user families, or difficult families in general. So we targeted children who were in boarding schools from difficult families, and in another program we targeted children who were living in normal families, quote-unquote, but they were themselves involved in alcohol use, drug use, or crimes. So reinforcing family importance for the normal families helped them be back more with families and less time in the street, while we didn't focus on family at all with children in abnormal families, which were in boarding schools. We targeted institution teachers, we targeted faith leaders who worked with them, but this approach helped them re-establish the value system, as they say during the evaluation, and prioritize their family more. So even without being intentional about family, but you know, focusing on value promotion in general, these children mentioned during the interviews for the evaluation that was important for them, and they reinvestigated the importance of the family in general for them. Meaning they spend less time in the streets, basically, or with risky behaviors. Bosnia and Herzegovina, we work with Roma women and youth, women and girls particularly, but mostly they are under 24 years of age. And Roma is the most marginalized population group in Europe, but their issues are unspoken. So many children are involved in child labor and risky behaviors. Alcohol use and drug use is kind of normal. So in our programming, we really had family-centered approach for HIV prevention that increased access to services. They don't know their rights for, you know, being eligible for services. And this program particularly helped for families, especially children and youth, accessing their rights for healthcare and for prevention. Well, the learning from our programs, very briefly, is, I already mentioned, I just want to summarize that it goes both ways. It's not that we focus on family-centered approaches to help those in families, but it helps marginalized groups themselves to less self-stigmatize and have easy access and better access to services. Like, for example, the police violence is hindering that access. Exactly that way, family-centered approach helps for better access and, better prevention. Then it also helped less attraction to streets for children and youth, and less time for risky behaviors. And most importantly, it created an enabling environment for children and youth to freely share opinions and access their rights and know their rights. So the recommendations are to intentionally plan family-centered approaches in your program designs. As I mentioned, in some of our programs, we didn't do that at first. Then we learned through our experience that this is important. So building family-centered approaches for children and youth particularly and dependents into program design will help implement it. So those elements of program should not come by the way ad hocly. And then tailor interventions for parents and caregivers for vulnerable children. Specifically, we kind of take it for granted that parents and children will be doing it, but it's not happening. So if we are intentional for helping them know how to help their children, that works. And of course, keep children and their rights in mind, even when they are invisible, because these children, especially in this region, they're mostly invisible. They are not seen. We don't speak much about them. So vulnerable children in Eastern Europe and Central Asia need protection, and right-based family approaches, family-centered approaches need to be part of program design. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marina. Our next speaker is it's quite easy for me to introduce her, as we have the privilege of having a plenary speaker from this morning. Elaine Abrams, she's professor in pediatrics at Columbia University and part of the Mailman School of Public Health. And we had this morning a fantastic presentation from her on vertical transmission, and now really we'll have an ability to listen to the role on family, and can probably go in a bit more details on the presentation this morning. Thank you for this morning's presentation.
Well, thank you so much. And as a pediatrician, I have some favorite children's stories, and one of my favorites is Martha the dog. And Martha's a dog who eats a bowl of noodles in the shape of alphabets, and she starts talking. And every day they give her more alphabets, and she keeps talking. And this is my sixth presentation in as many days, so I'm feeling a little bit like Martha the dog and hoping somebody will take my alphabets away from me so I could be quiet. So I'm going to try to very briefly talk with you about the role of families in the prevention of vertical transmission, and very specifically share with you the experiences from the MTCT Plus initiative as a family-focused program for women, children, and their families. Let's see if I can get this right this time. So first, I'm assuming that everyone has the take-home messages about when vertical transmission occurs and how and the risk factors, but I thought I'd spend a moment just talking about the spectrum of care and what it is that goes into actually trying to prevent transmission and the kind of services that need to be provided. I'm sorry that this is not projecting as well as it could, but I think what it does, it gives you a sense that prevention of mother-to-child transmission or vertical transmission is a long-term intervention for the woman and should really start at preconception, having a woman make a decision about whether a woman and family make a decision about more children. It requires testing both for HIV and CD4 during pregnancy, a safe delivery, and then it doesn't end there. It really continues until the child is well into the second year of life and until the mother is effectively engaged in HIV care for her own health. It should not just be about the baby, but more specifically about the mother. So effective PMTCT includes a series of both biomedical and psychosocial interventions that are administered throughout the reproductive life of a woman living with HIV. And really, you have to keep in mind that certainly in high prevalence settings, that women have multiple pregnancies. So this is often a recurrent pattern of care that will happen throughout a woman's reproductive life. On the other end of the spectrum is the care for the infant. And as I stated, it can last well into the second year of life, particularly if the child is breastfeeding. It starts at birth with antiretroviral prophylaxis. Now with the new guidelines, the baby or mom will be receiving prophylaxis throughout the first year of life. And there are multiple well-child and HIV-specific interventions that need to occur across this period of time. If you put it together, you actually have quite a lot to do as a service provider to ultimately result in a happy, healthy family. So let's look at the evidence around PMTCT or vertical transmission and family-centered care. By definition, it is a family focus or family-centered intervention because it entails the mother and the child, this dyad. It also provides an unparalleled opportunity to engage other family members in HIV as well as other health and social services. So it's an opportunity to test a husband or partner, other children in the family, and other extended family or household members, and to provide HIV testing, prevention, and care. It's a fabulous platform for all of these things. It's also a platform for other health services, particularly things like TB or early infant interventions. And ultimately, as I showed this morning, effective PMTCT prevents orphanhood because it should not only prevent infection in babies, but should effectively keep mothers and fathers healthy. There's also evidence that family involvement can enhance prevention of vertical transmission. Partner testing in vertical transmission programs has been associated with greater use of prophylaxis, higher acceptance of post-test counseling, and increased communication between partners about HIV and sexual risk. If you use PMT services as an entry point into care, you can also retain adults, particularly the pregnant woman and child, and have better adherence. Family-focused home-based testing has been very effective and can overall improve the health outcomes for both HIV-positive and negative family members. And disclosure status within the household has been associated with better pediatric outcomes. So I'll tell you a little bit about the MTCT Plus initiative. This is a multi-country HIV care and treatment program that use PMTCT as an entry point for pregnant women and postpartum women into comprehensive HIV care and treatment. It was also an entry point to identify other family members who were in need of HIV services. It reframed PMTCT in the context of the reproductive lives of women living with HIV, recognizing that pregnancy was a normal and expected aspect of a woman's life, and it aimed to support and maximize the health outcomes of the woman, the child, and the family. And it became a model for family-focused care. So there are many factors that shape the development of the MTCT Plus model, recognizing HIV as a multi-generational family disease where multiple family members across the generations could be infected, that all family members are affected by HIV once any member in the family has the infection, that most HIV care actually occurs outside the facility, but rather in households and among families, and that women and children in particular have multiple needs that are not just medical, but may impact adherence to their medical services. Families can be an important source of support for treatment, and that community and cultural factors impact on adherence and retention. So the M-Plus approach to care and treatment provided comprehensive primary care, which included antiretroviral therapy, which is somewhat different from many of the antiretroviral therapy programs that specifically enroll individuals who need treatment. It was family-centered, and at the time that it started in the early 2000s, was really revolutionary by including children. paid attention to a wide range of factors, provided care by multidisciplinary team, including social workers, nurses, and physicians, and involved persons living with HIV. These are all the countries where there were MTCT plus sites, 9 countries in Africa, as well as in Thailand. And women attending antenatal clinics would be tested for HIV, enrolled into PMTCT programs, and then offered enrollment into MTCT plus, where they got a package of care. They were invited to enroll HIV-infected partners and children. Over the course of the initiatives, there were 16,000 individuals, more than 16,000 individuals, enrolled, about 60% adults, and 6,000 children. For adults, about 40% started on treatment, and about 40% of women were enrolled during pregnancy. Of particular interest in the family-focused model is the enrollment of partners into HIV services using PMTCT as an entry point. And as you can see here, and notice this graph only goes as high as 35%, that during enrollment in the early 2003 to 2005, there was great variation by country where sites were located in the ability to enroll partners. Some countries did relatively well, while others only had modest numbers of partners enrolled. This is very dependent upon how individual programs were established, as well as things like migration within the community, whether men worked in distant places, and what other services were available. In the MTCT Plus initiative, the majority of women received multi-drug regimens for PMTCT. When women initiated HART during pregnancy, they had a robust, extremely robust response with over 450 CD4 cell response after 30 months. Retention in care and on treatment was unusually high for both women and men compared with reports from many ART programs. And women who started treatment were almost twice as likely to have a second child in the initiative than women who are just followed in care.
So Deo,
I'm hoping you can hear this. This is.
I coordinate the MTCT Plus clinic at Mulago Hospital. You have both members of the family involved in HIV care, the partners. Then you probably are going to have both of them live longer other than one stealthily getting treatment and also risking the possibility of passing over a resistant strain to the other partner, because there is no way the two are going to discuss protective methods, you know, against transmission if the other partner doesn't know. So I think, you know, it's an excellent model of HIV care.
Well, I'm not sure you could hear that any better than I could. That was Dr. Dio at the our Mulago MTCT Plus site, who was expressing the virtues of family-focused care. So you'll have to take my word for it. If you're in the hallway where the session rooms are and where those wonderful sculptures are, all the way at the end, there actually is a television that plays a series of films from MTCT Plus, all reflecting on the family-focused model of care. And I urge those of you who are around tomorrow to go see them. They're quite beautiful. So in conclusion, HIV infection affects the health and the well-being of families as well as individuals. Most prevention, care, and treatment programs have been established to address the needs of the individual, very often neglecting the family. Prevention of vertical transmission services offer an unequaled opportunity to address the comprehensive health needs of the mother and the child, to engage partners, children, and other family members, and to enhance PMTCT outcomes by engaging family members. To date, there have been very few models of family-focused PMTCT that have been either trialed or evaluated. But hopefully, with renewed global attention and commitment to the health needs of women and children, we'll have an opportunity to focus on families as a means to keep families healthy and children free of HIV infection. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Abrams. Our next speaker is Maurice Tomlinson. Maurice Tomlinson is an attorney at law in Jamaica and has been involved in HIV/AIDS and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex activism in Jamaica for over 12 years. He is company secretary and legal advisor to the Jamaican AIDS Support for Life, as well as legal counsel for Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays. He was recently appointed to the International Lesbian and Gay Association in Latin America and the Caribbean as a regional secretary for Gays Caribbean. Maurice is also a father to one biological child and two foster children, and one of whom is HIV positive. And we had the pleasure of having him speak at our meeting in February on especially marginalized groups and family-centered support. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, John. And thank you all for coming out. As John said, I know it's a very difficult time, but this is a very important topic. I'm going to just take you quickly through the outline of what I'm going to do today. I'm going to talk about the definition of what family-based care is to me and to the groups represented here, and what are the relevant legal issues that are thrown up from that definition, some international commitments in relation to MSM and the role and their participation in family-based care, the state of international and criminal MSM criminalization, just a quick overview, because I'm sure you've all heard this before. The impact of MSM criminalization in relation to family-based care from the Indian experience that we got some excellent work done by Dr. Sunil Solomon, and the impact on OVCs, orphans and vulnerable children, of MSM criminalization, that, you know, some examples or stories that we've heard. So, what is the definition of family-based care that, you know, we're working with? That it's a focus on the family as opposed to the physician. Family are the central deliverers of care, and that this care goes beyond medication. It involves adherence, the social aspect, emotional support, attendance to financial, physical, and other needs, and it therefore, you know, implicates a more holistic approach to care. And the reasons for family-based care are obvious, in that the healthcare provider cannot provide all the care all the time. They are responsible for providing care at the point of care, which is usually the hospital and or clinic. So family-based care is critical to ensuring an effective response to the HIV epidemic. What are the legal issues that arise in relation to family-based care and MSM? Well, firstly, disclosure. How much, when is it necessary, what is the type of disclosure that should be made, and the family types that are, you know, recognized for family-based care in relation to MSM. We have situations of opposite-sex married MSM, civil union or same-sex married MSM, MSM and children. Those are just some. I'm sure there are many other legal issues in relation to family types, but I have to be brief. So in relation to the family, the concept that is traditionally accepted in discourse about family is what you see here, mother, father, you know, the 2.5. However, the international commitments regarding MSM and family-based care don't make any such presumptions, actually. The international commitments, as are found in the treaties that are listed there, provide for privacy and non-interference with family and home of everyone, right to marry and to found a family of everyone, and the right to the highest attainable standard of health for everyone. So there is no distinction in any of the international treaties, at least that I have found, which predicate family, home, privacy, etc., on heterosexual context. It doesn't exist. All right. Yet, we see that in relation to one of these particular international treaties, the one that most persons will cite in relation to civil and political rights, family rights, etc., privacy, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, there is almost universal acceptance of this treaty. And therefore, its provisions in relation to privacy rights, family rights, etc., have reached the standard of, you know, almost customary international law. Yet, the picture in relation to laws regarding same-sex sexuality is a little different. As you must have heard before, you know, there are about 80 countries that still have criminalization to one extent or the other. Some have even the death penalty. All right? So what does this mean for family-based care? Well, I'd like to point to the Caribbean that I know a little bit about, where the regime in relation to criminalization of same-sex intimacy varies from life imprisonment in Guyana and Barbados to 10 years in Jamaica, Belize, Grenada, and some other countries. In Trinidad and Tobago, for example, it is criminal to enter the country if you are an MSM. The Constitution of Jamaica, just like many other Caribbean territories, have a provision in relation to privacy, which, coincidentally, also covers family life. And you'll see the relevance of all of this to family-based care shortly. So it says, whereas everyone in Jamaica is entitled to fundamental rights and freedoms, including respect for his private and family life, which would seem to be very clear, the constitutions have what is called a savings law clause, which means that any law which existed prior to our independence is saved, no matter how draconian and backward and, you know, archaic such law is. The result is that the 1864 Offences Against the Persons Act, which we inherited from Britain, which speaks to unnatural offences and outrages on decency, these laws are saved. And therefore, even though they directly impact on the right to privacy of MSM, they cannot be challenged in a domestic court. Parliament is the only agent that can change such laws. And of course, that has serious political implications in a context where the societies are still very conservative. In relation to MSM and family types, the general situation is that same-sex unions are rarely granted legal status. Definitely, in the Caribbean, it is not recognized. We see movement happening around the world and in Latin America, but definitely not in the Caribbean. There's a prohibition on same-sex union in a case called Corbett and Corbett, which can only be removed by legislative action, which seems quite unlikely. This prohibition has negative implications on provision of family benefits, healthcare attendance, etc. And we have a situation in some of our Indo-Caribbean populations, especially, where heterosexual marriages are entered into for family, financial, social, etc. reasons, often with tragic results. And that is why I thought it was important to look at the example of India and the implications of criminalization for family-based care in India, because it speaks to what happens. It resonates very well with what happens in the Caribbean. In India, in a study presented by Dr. Sunil Solomon, they found that there was a great deal of stigma and discrimination as a major concern, which is why there was non-disclosure about HIV status. The fear of acceptance by the family was a major barrier to disclosure. There was marriage due to parental pressure, and the criminalization meant that if they were discovered, they would have faced prosecution, so they would keep their condition secret, with the result, of course, that not only did they not receive the treatment they needed, but they also infected their family members, all right? And we see the statistics there. Only 2% disclosed to wives, 6 to family members, 15 to healthcare professionals, right? Now, I'm rocketing along. In relation to children and MSM, in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we see where the states' parties are required to protect the child and his family, parents, from discrimination, regardless of their status or, you know, any other criteria. And there's the catch-all phrase that the best interest of the child shall be the primary consideration. However, this has been interpreted in certain contexts, certainly in a Jamaican context, to mean that any situation which puts a child in moral danger or exposes a child to substantial risk can provide an opportunity for that child to be taken out of the situation. Now, normally that's a commendable thing. However, when you have laws such as the Offenses Against the Persons Act, which can be said, which criminalize same-sex activity, that can be used and has been used to separate families and to prevent children from remaining in their family situations where they can receive care. Because one partner, the surviving parent, might be an MSM. In our context, the penalty for not reporting what is considered abuse, which is exposing a child to moral danger or substantial risk, is a fine of $500,000 or to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 6 months or both. Right? And this is the finding in relation to MSM and exposure to moral danger. It is not substantiated by findings of longitudinal studies on the performance of children in same-sex households. The American Psychology Association has found as far back as 2005 that children raised in same-sex households are as well-adjusted as children in heterosexual households. And of course, there's ongoing studies to show that they're performing sometimes even better. But in the Caranatala case, which was out of Chile, and it has importance for us in the Americas, in the Caribbean, because we share the Inter-American Commission, where a lesbian judge living with her partner was denied custody of her 3 children because of perceived moral danger. The court found Inter-American Commission found on April 7, 2010, the same day we held our Walk for Tolerance in Jamaica, that discrimination against a parent in a child custody dispute because of her or his sexual orientation violates the American Convention on Human Rights. However, in Jamaica, the policy remains that the mother is usually best. No single male will be allowed to foster or adopt a female child. And from my personal experience, a single male adoption of a male child is always frowned upon, even if that child has no other means of care, even if that child is an OVC. I'm just going to quickly share a story, not my personal story, which is you can hear after, which is not being taped, of a situation where a Jamaican MSM sought to provide care, and the challenges he faced to provide care for an OVC who would otherwise have been left in an institution. So he heard about an orphan positive child. He took the child in an unofficial fostering arrangement, which is quite popular. After 3 years, he decided to adopt the child to give the child a sense of belonging, access to health care and other benefits. He applied to adopt the child through the adoption board, which did several home visits, interviews, etc. There was clear evidence that the child improved in all the markers from base characteristics. He was, however, met with resistance from the conservative female adoption officer, and he had to spend a tremendous amount of money to employ a senior counsel who eventually became the head of the adoption agency after this case was won. Or chairman of the adoption board. And the judge commented on the obstructive nature of the adoption official. The adoption was finally approved after 3 years. This flashing light is distracting me. But the time and the expense that this person undertook to get this child, not many persons would have been willing to undertake that. And, you know, the facts are that in Jamaica, within the Kingston metropolitan region alone, there are 8 infected children in children's homes receiving substandard care. Adoption of these children is a viable option to addressing this issue. However, and many MSM have expressed a desire to do so, but there are policy implications and impediments. So, in summary, criminalization of same-sex intimacy undermines family-based care by fostering non-disclosure. That's not rocket science. Non-recognition of same-sex union limits family-based care by denying family benefits. And finally, OVCs, orphans and vulnerable children's access to potential parents, is denied due to a homophobic childcare policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson, for a very compelling presentation about the barriers to this model from your perspective. Our last speaker, who is a discussant in this session, is Lakshmi Narayan Tripathi. Ms. Tripathi is a Hijra social activist working in the field of HIV and AIDS for the past 10 years. She's a founder of the CBO Astitva for the support and development of sexual minorities and a co-founder of the Asia-Pacific Network of Transgenders. She was the first transgender person to represent Asia-Pacific in the UN Civil Society Task Force. She's also an accomplished Indian dancer, an actress, and the first transgender entrepreneur, I believe, in India. Please welcome Ms. Tripathi.
Hi, good evening, everybody. I'm going to talk about sexual minorities, and especially now my counterpart spoke about MSM generally. But issue of sexual minorities is not as far as MSM, but even with the transgender community and ethnic communities of which even I represent, the Hijra, the oldest and the ethnic transgender group. In India, as far as MSM is concerned, there is lots and lots of work done. There are CBOs, NGOs, and the NACO's rule, and there is enough of money. But there are some rules where community care center and where even we commonly with MSM face a lot of problem. But one thing is very good about India is that the family structure is so much inborn in us and in our culture that though being MSM, if people are working in a CBO, it's like a family. Everybody is available for everybody. It's like that. As far as, of course, we have differences for each other, but politically we have differences. But when it comes to support each other, of course, we all come as a community in a very strong way. So MSM CBOs have really built up in supporting people living with HIV AIDS when they are in community care center or at their houses, because I have seen through my own 10 years of experience that how nobody was left alone till the last date or till the last breath. How everybody was intact. When there were no services, we fought for services together. In platforms where sexual minority was discussed, we fought for our own spaces, but when it was to access services, we were together. So that was MSM sector. Let me take you to India. India in itself is a continent, as we all know, so big, and we are such political people. We fight. So it's strange. So transgenders, I started way back in 1999 saying that to the government, we are not men, we are transgenders. Then suddenly some effeminate men stood up and said, we are transgenders. So I said, oh my God, then my community has again gone to one side. Then we said, okay, you have your space of transgender. We are Indian Hijras. Now Hijras in itself is a community altogether. It is a culture. It has been century down the lines in our continent. And it's the only sexual minority which is visible in our side, which is not only in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the Tarai region of Nepal. So this community is there. Like, for example, my guru is my guardian. father, mother, everything. If she dies, I inherit all her property. So it's in a way, and then my disciples are my children. The disciple, and like my guru has 15 other disciples, and I'm among 115. But whoever takes her care till her last breath deserves her property. That goes by saying, and it's like everything is with the community. But there was a position in our side that there are so much of myths and misconceptions. India being with so much of religion, religious gurus, and all the stuff. Hijra in itself is a religion. We follow both Islam and Hinduism very strongly. So our gurus have been really, it has not been changed from after the Britishers, what Britishers did to our communities also. It was tremendously, until now we have not come out of it. Lack of education system. So still we follow the old and the ethnic norms in our community. When we started our work, it was really very hard. So, and there is so much of myths and misconceptions about us and our community in the mainstream society. When we did our first, in 2002, we did our first central surveillance, positivity rate was 49%. And which I forced the government to do that. And that time, like, because I used to see people dying, doctors not touching them. There was an incident where one Hijra died at the door of a hospital. I reached there and she was dead. And we had a lot of fight because if at the right time medicines were given to her, and she would have been living till the date. But these incidents really gave a role to me to fight with the government and to access services, which is there. We have a beautiful, we have free drugs, which we get enrolled. But over there was a problem that how to touch a Hijra, healthcare providers. So it took us a long time in advocating and accessing services, what was there for us. Oh, it's gone? I'm not paying attention on your this, so you tell me when it is 7 minutes, because I can go on. And I love his smile. John is sexy. And then afterwards, and once I remember, I took 5 patients for the drugs, ART drugs, and the main doctor, you know, he became mad. He used an abusive language. And a big hospital, government hospital, on the first floor was the cabin. I dragged him with the collar and pulled him down on the street, you know. I hammered him. I'm a nasty activist, you know. But then afterwards, the press took it seriously. And one thing was very good, that the press supported us. And after that incident, everybody out of fear, but still we got access. It's anyway, we should receive access for the community. And then there were few very big cases where, you know, very rich gurus were there and, you know, they have lots of money with them. Because we have money from, like, it's hierarchy. After me, my disciples will get, and all the money is with the community. So they are rich. They can afford, but they don't know how to tackle HIV and AIDS. So when we started first, there was like, oh, we don't have sex because, you know, Hijras are not supposed to have sex because they are godly people. People are scared of their curse and believe in their blessing in our country. So when we asked for the project to the government and they said, you don't have sex. I said, excuse me, I'm as human as you. It's my basic necessity to have sex, you know, so that it started with that. Of course, we broke the ice and we got into it. Like, 2-3 hospitals were really very transphobic and hijraphobic, but we could achieve, you know. I used my femininity. Sometimes, you know, my strapless blouses made the good way to enter the man's world. You know, my sari used to just slip down and it was okay for the Indian man to pay more attention for us. But we did every method to get medicines, to get support. Now one rule is there in the community care center, if you put somebody, you require somebody for 24 hours, a family member to be there. That was not a big deal with us. For example, at the dawn of this conference, it's sad that I lost my disciple. I crossed the security and the immigrations of India, and I got the news that my disciple expired. Her name was Payan, and she was a wonderful cook. I will miss back home. And we never knew she was positive. In 4 days, everything happened. She became hepatitis positive, and she was HIV positive. Her kidneys failed. We could not save her. But 24 hours, there was a shift always within the family of our hijras that people would go and take care. We, at present, our organization doesn't have government funds, but we have our own system to access funds when it is required for people who are positive, people who cannot, because this disciple of mine was very near to me. I saw to it she was given the best medical facilities. One thing is good about India, that we transgenders and we hijras are totally out. There is nothing, but there is stigma. Visibility always gives stigma. If you're positive, it doubles the stigma. One thing, I'm really proud what we have in our country, and the hijra community especially, is the family bond between each other. And I believe that this is a good nature where the world should learn that immaterial to anything, we are one, and we should stand by each other, immaterial to our sexuality, our gender identity, or our age, youth, child, young, old, because HIV doesn't discriminate, so we shouldn't discriminate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn over to my co-chair, Stefan.
So much. Before we go into opening up for the floor, just sort of to recap a couple of things, I think what came out very strongly in this session is the importance of looking at the history of the AIDS response, which has focused predominantly in most areas on sort of individuals. So for a long time, the unit of analysis of our work, of our learnings, of our plannings, of our interventions was mostly around individuals. But kind of the home truth of the importance of families and that sort of network, clearly we need to shift. And I think we have seen over the last couple of years a gradual shift increasingly to focus the unit of analysis into families. And then we've heard sort of from the Eastern European region to see really the as well that it takes time to shift. And I think I talked with Marina shortly before the presentation, and she said it's good to see and hear as well in this conference that the families is much more mentioned. I was very pleased, for example, that Paul Delay, in most of his addresses, he always ends with the importance of fathers, families, and sort of bringing that concept in. The challenge, though, is really to shift from language to practice. And that is sort of the journey we have to go together over the next couple of years. Elaine sort of gave us a very in-depth, and I sort of really appreciated the slide with looking at that continuum in terms of family-centered interventions. And integration will increasingly be a very key theme. As we've heard as well in this conference, the UN Secretary General just launched a draft of a joint action plan for women's and children's health. And this is an opportunity to really bring up, and this morning Elaine had that sort of picture of the house, and I think some of us from the Coalition of Children Affected by AIDS would like to work with you on that picture, which is a good start, but I think there's more to it than these two houses bringing under one roof, so we can work together on that. Then thank you, Maurice. I think you brought up some real issues in terms of legislative challenges, and few of us actually look at sort of legislating pieces going back into sort of 1860. But we see that if we start to talk family-centered approaches, we don't have to be naive in the sense of just sort of within our immediate environment. We have to look at the whole legislative framework and what does it mean specifically to marginalized communities. And Lakshmi, thank you for, you know, bringing that, the Hiracha, the sort of the family bond. And what I picked is we are one and should stand to each other. And this is sort of this oneness, the concept of family across the various communities. Thank you.
It's very warm in here. I see my colleague from Jamaica fanning himself. They're not as used to the heat as we are in Canada. We have some time for questions, though. So please feel free to come to the microphone, introduce yourself, and tell us where you're from, and ask questions or of the panelists, or add your own experiences around family-centered support.
Thank you. Thank you for an excellent panel, and I have a question which is open to the whole panel. One of the things which strikes me consistently about family-based approaches is that they cost more because they are, or they appear to cost more because they are addressing the entire family rather than an individual approach. However, your evidence seems to suggest that, the eventual cost-benefit could be greater, and I wonder whether there was any scope or whether there had been any costing analyses done which could be used to help promote family-centered care.
I can say not that I know of. MTCT Plus was a demonstration project, so it was learning as it went along, so there wasn't any cost analysis. And as I said, there have been so few effect models that I don't think it's been done, but I honestly don't know.
Well, just two things on that question. UNFPA did a series of case studies, and they started to sort of look at some of the element of costing, but it's clearly important that we invest into actually looking at that costing. But I think Professor Linda Richter, she made a very important point related to the costing. It's you have to look at both sides of the equations. Cost to who? Is it costly, more costly to the service provider? Well, what about the cost of a woman who has to go first to get her family planning here, then get the AR visa over there, and if she has a child, she has to go on the other end of town. So the transport cost, the time cost, the emotional costs of not having that integration is a significant cost. And if we do costing analysis, let's look on both sides of the equation.
Quick response. Well, the Uzbekistan example I mentioned for the family-centered approach that we introduced into the program later on didn't cost us anything, simply because we were bringing dependents to the same counseling that we were inviting the drug users to come in the trust point. And at the same time, we were doing all the other interventions because it was a comprehensive program. Like, we were addressing them in the shooting galleries, and their peers were doing it. It's not that the program staff was doing it. So it was very much peer-to-peer approach, but also professional counseling to dependents and family members. It didn't cost us anything. Zero additional dollar was spent, basically, but it really added huge value to the program, and to the it benefited the program a lot.
Thank you. My name is Noreen Honey from REPSI, as well as RIAT Eastern Southern Africa. I have comments. My first comment is it's good to hear the different types of families presenting on strengthening families. I think that's a positive direction to where the response is going. I would have loved to hear a little bit more about households that are being headed by children. And then secondly, my question is, does anyone of you have experience or information about what could be the psychological effects of the different types of families that you are representing? Thank you.
I think your first point is very excellent. The reality is two of the children that we eventually took into our care through Jamaica Aid Support for Life were heading households where their parents had both died. And they were just, you know, happened upon by chance. And it really would be important to identify, you know, what is the level of care they were able to provide for their other siblings who were also infected. It's a very excellent question. In relation to your second question, I believe in, that's my new mantra, you know, hard evidence over hysterical emotion. And I know that in our society in Jamaica, there's a tendency to think that once it's a non-normative situation, then the children must be hurt. They must be harmed by that situation. Yet, longitudinal studies are being, you know, going on in the United States by the American Psychological Association, which is informing us that, you know, the children are performing quite well in the non-normative context. And so, for me, that kind of research is simply exciting, you know. We just have to rely on other studies. I'm sure other studies are being done elsewhere in the world, but certainly what's coming out right now is that the children are performing, you know, they're, all their indicators are just as good.
On the child-headed household question, I published a study in 2005 focusing on sort of coping capacities and quality of life of child-headed households in urban southern Africa. And what came out very clearly in that study was that actually if you have mobilized communities and community support and neighborhood support, child-headed households, they reconstitute themselves into these family clustered within the neighborhood. And we identified that situations where sort of social welfare or social workers interfered and sort of broke up these family concepts, that it was detrimental to the individual children by breaking them up, whereas within a neighborhood-supported child-headed household concept, you know, the family unit was carrying on fairly functioning well.
I would like to add upon to the second question you told, that as I told you that the guru in our community, we have gurus and who decide, the heads of the community, who decide what is good and bad for the community. So when we started condom giving, they said we are not into sex. And only the community who used to, the part of, we have three profession. One is to blessing, one is begging, and one is sex work. Only the sex work group used to take condoms. But when people started dying due to HIV/AIDS, the whole shift changed, that they were emotionally scattered. And then they realized, then they took a stand not to poke their nose in any of the health issues of the community. And it brought more strength together to the community to be together and to be one. Because I remember an incident where one of the gurus threw a disciple out of the house because she was positive, but the head of the communities took a decision to find the guru and to pay for her all the health services to be required in a private setup. So that brought oneness together back to the community, which was losing away.
Hello. My name is Krista Lauer. I'm with the Global Forum on MSM and HIV. I would like to really applaud this panel. I thought it was very well done, and I'm especially appreciative of the panelists who provided some insight into families that don't necessarily adhere to heteronormative assumptions of what makes up a family unit. So thank you very much. And to that effect, I was wondering if the panel could speak a little bit more about creating enabling environments for these families to access family-based care. Certainly there was an excellent analysis of some of the structural and legal dimensions that provide barriers that need to be addressed, but beyond legal reform, are there any other practical strategies that can help create this enabling environment for broader access? Thank you.
Shall I say? Community-based organization should be strengthened, because that is an example of what I have seen, which plays in a very strong way. Because where community is given the power to take up the comprehensive projects, there the oneness and family being becomes more stronger, and the approach becomes much more, you know, it's an authentic approach towards that community, which is not so heterosexual community. We are not heterosexual, nor MSM. But one thing we have seen is that we coming together and having the power in our hand, and we know it's sometimes people have power, but they don't know how to, you know, give out. And but there are good, noble projects across the world which should be taken into consideration and made it happen across the world.
I just wanted to also comment that one, a number of us have been having discussions at this conference about the need to address the very real issues that staff, workers in aid service organizations and healthcare organizations and hospitals and other kinds of healthcare workers and social service workers are having in providing services to especially marginalized populations in a family-centered way, and that there is a real need for either standards or guidelines or a set of guiding principles to break down stigma, but also to allow those workers to deal with some very real issues that are emerging because of legal frameworks in various countries, or that where rights can collide. So where they may have duty to report sexual abuse, for instance, and how that might impact on the inadvertent disclosure of someone's HIV status when they do that. The issues of MSM in particular and sex workers and IDUs bring these issues to the fore, especially when people carry with them all sorts of discriminatory notions. And it's very hard for workers to pick them apart, and I think we've been burying our heads in the sand about addressing these issues so that the barriers are broken down.
If I can just make one final quick comment on this point, anyway, the situation in Jamaica recently occurred where the Minister of Education had withdrawn a book from the syllabus, which had been approved actually by his own ministry, talking about families. And in that book, there was a reference to non-normative families as being families, as being a form of families. And there's definitely the attempt to miseducate the Jamaican students about the existence of these kinds of families. So, and there is the reason this is allowed is because of the law. So, you know, the law which criminalizes same-sex intimacy. So even though the facts are that such families exist, you can deny their existence from a policy level because the law says they shouldn't exist. So you have to start with the law.
I am Janet Ulate from World Vision Canada. I would like the panel to talk about challenges, like the social cultural factors around the role in families, the role of the family in vertical transmission. Not always is so positive. We did an operational research and found there were factors that were an obstacle for the women to continue in the care, and the opposition of grandmothers, mothers-in-law, husbands, and extended family that can be sometimes a challenge for the service.
Does anybody?
I think you're talking about a number of different things. So those are not necessarily challenges to family-focused care. Many of those things have been identified as challenges to PMTCT. And that's, I think, somewhat different. I think the major challenge to family-focused care is getting buy-in to actually try and do that. But I can speak to the experience with the MTCT Plus initiative, where we thought that simply by empowering women to bring in their families, that would be the end. And, of course, they'd bring in their families, and that turned out not to be the case. As you saw from the partner enrollment, that many women didn't want to disclose to their partners. Many women lived in discordant partnerships. Many women had children who were living outside of their homes with grandmothers and such. So to the actual details of providing family-focused care turn out to be quite complex and have to be really fine-tuned to the particular environment. And many of these barriers are the things that have been talked about for the last 4 days around stigma, gender inequity, educational level, and marginalized populations.
We had a presentation at the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS's meeting on especially marginalized populations in February by Dr. Katya Burns, where she highlighted that, yes, sometimes families can in them and of themselves be a liability. They're not always supportive and loving, particularly with drug-using mothers, and that there's a lot of that we have to remain. And I think Dr. Abrams has been pointing out some of those challenges as well.
Well, I would like to sort of make note, when you get out, you know, please take a copy of the Journal of the International Aid Society, where together with the International Aid Society, the Coalition on Children Affected by AIDS, and the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and AIDS, put together sort of a collection of evidence-based articles, and the publication is called Family-Centered Services for Children Affected by HIV and AIDS, and it's a very useful publication. So please, when you get out, pick some of these on the table there.
Yeah, my name is Mark Ottenweller. I'm with Hope Worldwide. And I guess one concern is that we've talked about the rights of almost everyone here except for the 16 million orphans and vulnerable children in Africa. And my question is simply, in your organizations, how do you envision extending the family approach to those orphans and vulnerable children?
Well, for me, the option would be to allow other family types to be recognized. I mean, that's what we're advocating in Jamaica, allowing other, you know, normative families to get the benefits to take care of these orphan and vulnerable children. But the hassle, especially in my context, of taking in such a child would just dissuade, for example, an MSM or, you know, a lesbian couple from doing that. And I'm speaking from the Caribbean's perspective. I don't know what the percentage or availability of that, you know, is in Africa.
In terms of the question specifically, I think, you know, you were referring more as well to Africa. I think there's two key elements. I think one is, you know, ensure that we, you know, keep mothers alive. That's and, you know, and keep children with parents. So that in terms of the situation of treatment is very important, so because you were referring to orphans and vulnerable children. Secondly, children have a right to a family. That's enshrined within the CRC. And if we look at the large numbers of orphans and vulnerable children, they do tend to have some form of family networks. But quite often, issues related to family reunification, issues, again, coming out of the study on childhood households, the key determining factor whether childhood households had, you know, existed was actually family conflict before the onset of HIV. And so issues around family support is so critical. In the Children AIDS pre-conference, we had a very interesting study presented from China, which was looking at the psychological and sort of psychosocial outcomes of children within kinship families, sort of family homes and institutions. And the sort of, you know, the results showed that, against sort of what our experience in Africa is, that children within the family sort of home were better off than children in the kinship home. However, when we then asked the question to the presenter, we quickly found out that the government was supporting the home arrangement, but the government was not supporting at all the kinship families. Now you compare sort of, you know, strawberries with peaches. And whereas if you start to invest the same resources into supporting families and kinship networks to take care of the children, and then have a social protection networks. And I think for Africa, that is the most important aspect for orphans and vulnerable children and families, is social protection, which gives the economic basis for family to cope.
Are there any other questions? If not, I'd like to thank all of our panelists for very interesting presentations. To thank you for coming.